Random House Audio Roads presents 60 Days in Combat by Dean P. Joy. Read for you by Don Hastings. It was a somber bunch of 71st Division infantrymen who loaded on dozens of 6x6 trucks the afternoon of March 6, 1945, for the short ride to the railhead at Yerville, a few miles south of Saint-Laurent, France. As I thought back over all that had gone wrong with my plan since volunteering, it was a bitter pill to swallow. 10 months earlier, in 1943, 1 month shy of my 19th birthday, I had volunteered reluctantly to be drafted into the Army Air Corps to avoid being sent straight to the dreaded infantry. Shortly after my induction, I was accepted into the Army Specialized Training Program, ASTP, which meant that I would be sent to college to study engineering, and in 2 years I would have a degree and become an officer and a gentleman in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineering or the Air Corps, not the infantry. But it was not to be. Toward the end of February 1944, it was announced that the ASTP would be abolished and that most of the men in my unit would be sent to the infantry. I thought of all the letters in which I had written the prophecy that the war would end before we saw any combat. I thought, Dean, what a stupid optimist you have been. Our train left the Yerville yard sometime after noon and headed east toward the front. Our route took us north of Paris, then east to Nancy and Lunéville. Just before dusk on the second day, we unloaded at the small town of Lenning in the Vosges mountain foothills of the province of Alsace-Lorraine. From there, the 2nd Battalion, 5th Infantry, was taken by a truck to a smaller village in Alsace, where we arrived after dark. To the tune of distant artillery rumbling a few miles to the east, G Company formed ranks in a narrow street, and each platoon was assigned to a house or a hayloft for the night. The 5 squads of our weapons platoon, 2 machine gun squads and 3 mortar squads, were assigned to a 2nd-story hayloft over one of the old houses. The hay in the loft was warm and dry, and we were warned not to smoke up there for fear of fire. We were also warned not to fraternize with any civilians, because it was said that some of them might be German spies. I, for one, didn't see a civilian during our short stay in that village. At this point, it seems appropriate to summarize what the overall situation was on the Western Front in Europe by that second week in March 1945. The 6 Allied armies under Eisenhower's Scheiff command in northwestern Europe were stretched over a front of nearly 400 miles, from Holland in the north to Switzerland in the south. More than 300 miles of that front was manned by 1 million or more American combat troops, supported by another 1 million or 2 in the rear areas, including the 8th and 9th U.S. Army Air Forces. This compares with perhaps 300,000 British and Canadian combat troops along a 50-mile front on the far northern flank, and no more than 100,000 French combat troops, all equipped with American arms, along a shorter front on the far southern flank. The British 2nd and Canadian 1st Armies under Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery were ever so slowly battering their way through Holland toward the Lower Rhine. On Monty's right flank, the U.S. 9th Army under General William Simpson had entered a corner of Germany and would soon reach the west bank of the Rhine opposite Dusseldorf. South of the 9th was General Omar Bradley's 12th Army Group, composed of General Courtney Hodges' U.S. 1st Army and General George Patton's 3rd Army. These 2 armies had mopped up after the Battle of the Bulge, cleared the Germans out of Belgium and Luxembourg, and were both now on German soil. Part of the 3rd Army was nearing Koblenz, and part was preparing to attack through the Saar region toward the Rhine cities of Mainz and Worms. To complete the picture, the 6th Army Group under General Jacob Devers, made up of General Alexander Patch's U.S. 7th Army, and General Jean de Lattre de Tassigny's French 1st Army, were holding primarily defensive positions on the southern part of the front. The 7th Army was in the Vosges Mountains, facing a segment of the Siegfried Line that extended west from the Rhine to Saarbrücken, and the French 1st Army was deployed along the Rhine from Strasbourg to the Swiss border at Basel. On Saturday afternoon, March 10, we were told that trucks would arrive before dark to take us to a quiet sector in which the Green 71st Infantry Division would relieve the veteran 100th Infantry Division on a ridge in the Vosges, a a few miles to the east. What a miserable ride that was. Within a mile or two, we turned off the road, and from that point the convoy traveled cross-country, much of the time winding its way slowly through dense evergreen forests, trying to avoid the ditches alongside the trail. We finally came out onto a paved road at about 11 p.m., and soon we pulled into a large square, paved with brick in the center courtyard of a bombed-out glass factory complex. We saw bright flashes on a nearby ridge atop a sheer cliff across the square, and heard the unmistakable coughing of a battery of 4.2-inch heavy mortars lobbing shells overhead toward the enemy lines. We dismounted near the large doorless entrance to one of the largest factory buildings. Soon the battalion commander's jeep drove up. After the jeep left, Staff Sergeant Cree gathered his three mortar squads in a circle. He said the Germans had been sporadically shelling the square, warned us not to smoke or show any lights, then told us to bed down under cover just inside the open doorway behind us. Decker, Hatley, Vincent, and I followed Sergeant John Rowan, our mortar squad leader, into the dark factory. He found a clear area where we had us drop our packs. I spread my shelter half in blankets on the grimy concrete, and using my pack for a pillow, slept fitfully for a few hours remaining until dawn. To the front. The noise of a truck pulling up outside the glass factory woke me at dawn on what was to be my first full day of frontline combat. Rowan had already gone outside, leaving his neatly rolled pack behind. Outside, G Company's two jeeps and a kitchen truck were parked close to the foot of the cliff across the square. A line of sleepy GIs were filling their canteens from a tripod-mounted water bag as they shuffled up to the open bed of the truck, from which one of our cooks was dispensing hot coffee from the spigot of a large urn. Assistant Gunner Glenn Decker and I pulled our aluminum canteens and cups from the canvas pouches hooked to our pistol belts and ran to join the line across the square. We saw Rowan and our other two mortar squad leaders by one of the jeeps, coffee cups in hand, looking at a map with Sergeant Feltman, Lieutenant Tyler, and Captain Neal. We were close enough to hear Neal say, "Okay, then. Odd man wins." And the three squad leaders each flipped a coin. We wondered what kind of game they were playing. After the cooks had filled our mess kits, Decker, Hatley, Vincent, and I sat with our backs against the stone wall of the factory to eat what was to be our last hot breakfast for several weeks. Between mouthfuls of greasy spam and tasteless powdered eggs, the four of us talked in subdued voices, remarking on the fact that the 4.2-inch mortars on the ridge above the cliff had ceased firing sometime before dawn. The silence seemed to confirm that the Green 71st was to take over a quiet sector. As we walked over to wash our mess kits in the drums of scalding hot water by the kitchen truck, Johnny Rowan whispered that he had some good news. "You and me are lucky," he said. "We don't have to hike up to the line like the rest of the company. We're going to ride up." "How come?" I asked. "The old man wants us to take a mortar and a radio up this morning to get a look at the layout in daylight," he explained. "Just the two of us. The 100th Division is going to send a jeep down to pick us up at about 10 o'clock. Better get your stuff ready." "This morning?" I croaked. "In broad daylight?" Rowan grinned and said, "Sure, why not? You want to walk up carrying a mortar? Jeez, Joy, I thought you'd jump at the chance to ride. Anyway, the captain is happy I won, and he knows you're the best gunner in the company. He told me we'll have the honor of being the first two guys from G Company to go up, maybe even the first from the whole division." I wanted to tell John Rowan to take that honor and shove it. I tried not to show my fear as I walked back to get the rest of my gear from the factory, leaving him to explain the plan to Decker and the others. I thought, my God, in just 2 hours I will be headed for the front line in a jeep. And that was how Rowan and I were to arrive at the frontline village. We may well have been the first two guys from the 5th Infantry Regiment to get up to the front, but we never did know for sure. First time under fire. In 1945, the tiny Alsatian village on what was called Skyline Drive consisted of just one street. All of its houses except the first one were in a line facing each other on both sides of the road, which ran slightly uphill to the right from where the jeep dropped us off. At the third house up the street, on the left, we met the weapons platoon sergeant of the company we were to relieve.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?